Hello, welcome to OS News Podcast, episode number 17 for July the 13th, 2009. I am speaking as Croc Cayman, and I'm joined by...
Tom Howard, as always.
A pretty short week, relatively speaking. I think everybody's been, being as brave as to venture outside into the bright sun. So we're going to keep the topics thin this time, but I think try and fill them out as much as possible, actually spend some time discussing them.
Yeah, it's been a slow news week and a slow news week anyway, because obviously it's summer and people are not really interested in technology right now. They're interested in vacation and, you know, in the beach and everything, so there's not a lot of news anyway this week.
But what news we have, we think, is pretty good. Obviously, like the Google thing, which we will cover. We'll start the show with feedback that we got from on the last podcast, which was pretty good this week. So thank you, readers, listeners, commenters. Okay, do you want me to start?
Yeah, we probably should start with the one about the audio tag, because...
All right, you think you do that? All right, yeah. Down the bottom here. This is by Brunus, and he says, or she says, we don't know, with all the fuzz Croc made about the video without JavaScript, why you choose to use Flash to stream audio? Well, that's simply because OS News' HTML is not mine to play with how I see fit. And there's a number of issues with that. I haven't actually created audio for everybody yet, so... although it's probably very easy to do so, I haven't. I've been busy with other things to get around to that. Also, the other issue is that we'd have to re-encode all the podcasts into OGG, and I've actually lost the original files for a lot of them, so they'd have to be transcoded from the MP3s, so that some of the OGGs would be really, really low quality. And the other thing is there's nothing preventing you clicking the MP3 link to download it, and in most cases the MP3 will play in your browser anyway if you've got QuickTime or MPlayer or something like that. So it's not that you, because we're using Flash, that you can't access the MP3 in any other way, like say with a video when people use Flash and the fallback just says download Flash and that's it, and it's completely unhelpful. It doesn't let you download the video. You can subscribe to the podcast, think it in your aggregator or your music app, or you can just download the MP3 directly. So don't feel like we're inhibiting people by using a small Flash player. That's there just purely for convenience, and in the future I think we will sort out an audio thing, but that's just not right now.
Okay, that's pretty good. Then we got another comment that we should probably touch on by Post Diction. Again, we obviously don't know if it's a he or a she.
We just read this paragraph by paragraph. It's quite long, but it's well written and it's well said, so I think it's worth reading the whole thing.
We should probably cover it. Hey Tom, first let me thank you and Kraft for putting out an interesting podcast. You both do a great job, blah blah blah. Thank you. I have not made it all the way through this episode, but I have to call you out on a couple of things. Okay, there we go, back against
the wall. Bring out your dead!
Yeah. Plus one for the reference to MultiPython. The first one. Why should any US-based company give away its content online for free to non-US-based IP addresses? And then he writes, the whole model of creating content is based on making a show, then letting viewers watch, and then selling advertising that applies to that audience. So essentially, they pay for making and distributing the TV show by advertising dollars. Well, that's pretty obvious, obviously. You say that it does not cost NBC anything to let you watch 30 Rock. I didn't specifically refer to 30 Rock, actually, but it is a good example because I really, really like 30 Rock. Then he goes on, who pays for the servers? Who pays for the bandwidth? Ads pay for all those things. Now, most of companies that advertise on Hulu, HBC.com, are US-based, selling to US customers. Most of the ads are useless to people outside of the US, so why should NBC let you watch 30 Rock when they can't make money advertising to you? Well, basically what I want to say here is Hulu and ABC and all the others, welcome to the modern world. The modern world isn't really limited anymore by borders, so whether you're in the United States or in the Netherlands or in Kazakhstan or whatever, you've got access to content from all over the world. So if you... let me put it another way. I think NBC and the other companies are actually limiting themselves in their income by focusing just on the American market. Google can serve me ads that are specifically tailored for me in the Netherlands, no matter what website I visit, whether that website is located in Antarctica or in Greenland. It doesn't matter. I get ads that are targeted to me. And I see absolutely no reason why NBC wouldn't be able to do the same thing. The reason they're not doing that is because the broadcasting networks in Europe actually buy the shows from America and then broadcast them here, usually a couple of months, but no, sometimes a couple of months later, which is okay, but usually a year later or maybe even 2 years later. And what they don't want, and then if NBC were to put their content online right away and let us watch it as well, then the value of those shows would go down when it comes to selling them to Europe. So it's not necessarily, it doesn't really have to do with not being able to give it to us or having to give it to us for free, because it will be trivial for them to make ads that are targeted to Europe or even to the Netherlands. It doesn't really matter. It's no problem to them. The issue is that they probably make more money selling their shows to European broadcasters than it is to put them online via advertisements. The problem with that, of course, is that we have the internet. And in many, well, in some European countries, at least in mine, it's not illegal to download those shows off, for instance, using a torrent or whatever, and watching them that way, because I'm not waiting 2 years or a year just to watch my favorite show and then be spoiled on the internet by spoilers that you accidentally click on or whatever. I just don't want that happening. So what I usually do is when an episode is released in the United States in the next morning, I download it via torrent and watch it in the evening here at home. So they're losing money on that one because the torrents don't give them any money at all. So I'm not entirely sure if those companies in the United States are ready or at least have adapted well enough to the fact that there's an internet out there. The old model is make show in the United States, broadcast, sell it to Europe and let them broadcast it a year later. But that model isn't working anymore because of the internet and people are free access to all these shows now. So it's not necessarily, I mean, they can continue what they do now and not let me watch those shows, but the consequence is that I'm not going to wait for broadcasters in Europe to broadcast those shows, because then I'd have to wait a year or 2 years and we get irregular schedules, and it's really a pain in the bum to keep track of all that stuff. So what I do is I just download them. It's completely legal in my country, so there's absolutely nothing stopping me from doing that. So it's basically their loss, not mine. I'm just telling them that they could make it easier. Not only they can make it easier for me, while still making more money on their end by putting ads in there, because I have no problems with watching ads. For instance, the show that does it perfectly well is South Park. They have South Park Studios website. The South Park episode is broadcast in America, and a couple of hours later, it's on southparkstudios.com. It usually contains a number of ads, and that's where I watch my South Park. So I don't actually download South Park. I watch it on their own website, and that's how those companies should do it. And then he continues the commenter by saying, there's the argument that if you watch 30 Rock and like it, they might buy the DVD, so they're getting you as a customer. But in my opinion, this is a weak argument. Well, that kind of depends on your position. You obviously live in the United States, which the commenter lives in the United States. So yeah, from your perspective, me not actually buying the DVD but just downloading them would be against the law. Well, it's not against the law here, so there's no problem for me. But actually, I do buy the shows that I like on DVD. I got a whole closet filled with them here. So it's a weak argument for some people, but it's not specifically in my case. And then he adds, also, the US is not the only country that does this. I don't know if this is still true, but when it was first released, I tried using the BBC player to watch shows, and it was blocked because I was in the US.
Yeah, that's still true. You can't access the BBC iPlayer is only for the UK. That said, there's one main reason that could be argued for that is that it's actually paid for by the British public. It's a publicly funded broadcasting agency, not private like the American broadcasters who make their money on advertising. The BBC is actually funded by British taxpayers.
Yeah.
So technically we own that content, although we still don't have access to the content that we really should. actually...
But just to get to that point, this is a logical fallacy. Just because someone, because person X does something, doesn't mean person Y should be allowed to do the same thing. It's not an argument. You're not making any point by saying the US is not the only country that does this. It doesn't make it right, or it doesn't make it, you know, it's not an argument in any way.
Yes. One thing I want to add that this reminded me of is Tim Berners-Lee was recently interviewed about the World Wide Web being 20 years old, and a question that was put to him was, what's the future of video on the web? And he said, As a consumer, I feel that I should be able to get to, and pay for if necessary, anything that has ever been broadcast. I'm looking forward to a time when the BBC archive is online and I can get BBC content from the US. I'm prepared to pay. The common thread is random access. The concept of a channel is going to be history very quickly. So I think he's seeing it right there, is that the somehow we've got to get over this old system and get to the way of just having everything on random access on the web to be able to access anything that's ever been broadcast how you want, and to subscribe and pay if necessary. That's not unreasonable to ask. Because there's different, you know, payment models. Some work better than others, some work for certain kinds and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that the old system just isn't, it's not good enough for some people, and the way they want to watch television and the time that they have and the devices that they have, and that the old methods don't really work.
Yeah, that's true. So, but again, I mean, I think the South Park studios really show how it should be done. So it's broadcast on normal television. A couple of hours later, it's up on the website with a bunch of ads intermingled, and that's it. And, it's, and you get perfect quality. You can, you know, you can blow it up to your screen size, and you still get good quality. The streaming is very well done. It always works, by the way. Of course, the website uses a lot of flash, but okay, I'll forgive them that. So so it is possible to do it. Now, obviously, South Park is probably a lot cheaper to make than, say, for instance, Lost or something like that. So there is, of course, in that sense, it is easier to put something like South Park online than it is like a really big show like Heroes or Lost or whatever. But still, I think that it's perfectly well possible to indeed to do something like Tim Berners-Lee, like the Tim Berners-Lee that you just explained. I think that's definitely possible.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to point two. I'll cover this, or okay. Read it at least anyway. Normal people do not use Linux because it is still more difficult to use, and also because it is not as packaged as well. To get people to switch from Windows, you have to make it easier than Windows. Why can't we get a logical file system? OS X is dead simple to use, and that is why they are seeing a rise in market share. I have a CS degree, and I know my way around computers, but still struggle with Ubuntu once a week. The point often made is that Linux is easy to use, it is just that people are most familiar with Windows, so anything different is harder. Well, that may be so, but to beat Windows you have to be better.
I don't understand the last sentence.
To beat Windows you have to be better. Well, actually, let me bring up my RSS read. I've got something saved in here, because this is a topic I wanted to discuss. I think we're probably going to get to this with Chrome OS anyway. But a lot of what he said with scroll down to this and find it. Slow responsive. There we go. Okay. Now this is something that John Grubb, Daring Fireball, said in regard to the Chrome OS thing, so we could probably get to that at that point anyway. But he said, in inverted commas, Linux means different things to different people. At a precise technical level, Linux is not an operating system. It is a kernel that can serve as the core for an operating system. What most people mean by Linux, though, is an operating system built around the Linux kernel for use as a desktop PC system. All the various Linux distributions are basically the same thing. They are variations of GNOME or KDE sitting atop the ancient X window system. Ubuntu is almost certainly the pinnacle of these distributions, but they're all conceptually the same thing. And the only significant difference is the choice between GNOME and KDE, and even there you're just choosing between two different environments that are conceptually modelled after Microsoft Windows. The entire X Windows stroke GNOME stroke KDE desktop Linux in inverted commas racket has never caught any traction with real people. Almost no one wanted it, wants it, or will want it. What he's saying is that the stack, the whole Linux stack that sits above the kernel, is... we're stuck in a rut of something that's forever chasing Microsoft and trying to be Windows, or just Windows with more options, and there's nothing fundamentally better than Windows other than the freedom aspect, and not everybody gets the freedom aspect.
Well, I'll kind of be the devil's advocate here, but I don't really see any difference between macOS 10, Windows, or Gnome KDE anyway. For me, they're all the same. They all work essentially. There are some small differences, but in the end, they all work the same. If you can use Windows, you can use the Mac, and if you can use the Mac, you can use Linux. If you can use Linux, you can use Windows. Specifically referring to the graphical environment, of course, because the belly of the beast, basically, of course, is different, but that's advanced stuff anyway. So I don't really see that much of a difference. As most of you will know by now, I'm currently still... I'm actually now almost done with the review of the Amiga. And when I use the Amiga, you really realize what a different desktop environment looks like and how a different desktop environment functions. But in the end, I respect John Gruber, but I don't agree. Because basically what he's implying that the macOS environment is distinctively different from Windows in a way that Gnome and KDE are not.
I don't think he was implying that, actually, because he didn't say anything about OS X in this whole discussion. I think he is focusing on the microcosm of Linux, and whilst we don't know his opinion as far as macOS X, if he regards it as not the same as that, I actually do. I would follow your same reasoning and say that OS X is just as much as Windows anyway as Gnome and KDE. But the core point is that they are. These desktop environments is, I think, for the most part stagnant. In fact, the whole desktop environment is for the most part stagnant.
Uh-huh.
And what the user was saying here, our commenter, was saying that to beat Windows, you have to be better, like not just a bit better, you have to be stupidly insanely better, and that you can't just keep improving Gnome and KDE. You cannot polish Gnome or KDE anymore or make it any more better than Windows. It's got to be a radical, something much more radical, shift in design. And this is why Linux is not getting any much traction, because it is not much better than Windows.
Well, I think it's another really, because the commenter also said OS X is that simple to use, and that's why they are seeing a rise in market share. I think a lot of the rise in market share when it comes to OS X can also be attributed to the combination of macOS X and the
marketing.
Hardware. I think not necessarily marketing, but because I don't think many people, at least not here in Europe, you don't see Mac commercials on TV anymore.
Yeah, not so much in the Europe. But then their increase in sales also match their marketing. They've had less increases in UK and Europe than they have in America.
Yeah, okay.
So.
But the point I was trying to make is that I think the fact that macOS, Apple is seeing a rise in sales isn't necessarily because of OS X. Because I don't think a lot of people even know what it's like to switch to OS X or see OS X and then want to switch to OS X. I think it's more
computer.
Wanting to switch
to
the
nice
hardware.
Looking computer.
Yeah,
they want to switch to hardware.
Because they buy a computer in the store, for instance, a Windows box, and they're getting some cheap brand, whatever. And in 1 year, it's filled all with stuff, and it doesn't work, and it's starting to slow down. And then they have their local nerd that says, well, macOS X doesn't have that problem. That nerd won't even say macOS X doesn't have the problem. Macs don't have the problem.
Yep.
So that person goes to the Apple store and buys a computer from Apple, and the software is just an additional bonus in that regard. So I don't think it doesn't have to do necessarily with macOS X. It has to do with
the package, which what we were saying before is in the actual podcast is that it's not Linux isn't packaged as a whole, and it could probably do better when it gets more OEM strong arming, and
What Dell is doing right now. I think Dell
is
really going into the right direction here with Ubuntu and really working.
Although they still say Dell recommends Microsoft Windows Vista.
Yeah, obviously. Okay, but you can't switch an entire company within a year. That's not possible. So, but in any case, they're making an effort out of it. They're not just putting some
weird stuff
in there.
And to support it as well, because that was, if anything, shipping Linux is quite easy. Supporting it is a whole different thing. You've got to get the technical skills and the staff to be able to do that. And computer support is already difficult enough as it is for most companies, let alone doing it with Linux.
Yeah.
Which is just a different ecosystem that you have to gear up to.
Yeah.
Let's carry on. Next paragraph. Another big problem for Linux is drivers. You said you believed that CUPS is better than a Windows and Mac, and I will say it is better than Mac, but realistic dude, every printer... I'm not sure what he was trying to say there. Every printer is first made to work with Windows, and then people get around to making it work with Linux. That's very true. I currently have an Epson CX4600 all-in-one that works perfectly in XP Vista and OS X, but prints everything in Cyan under Ubuntu. I'm sure this is just anecdotal evidence, but I shouldn't have to struggle with my printer to make it work. For Windows Mac, all I do is download the drivers and works.
I want to get into... I want to chime in on this one. Indeed, this is anecdotal evidence, because I'm looking to my left now and I'm looking into one of my closets and I'm seeing a printer over there, a perfectly functioning printer. It was back then a relatively expensive Hewlett Packard inkjet printer, but that printer was bought before Vista. It doesn't work in Vista, it doesn't work in Windows 7 because Hewlett Packard refuses to make drivers for Vista and Windows 7. It works perfectly in Ubuntu. I just have to plug it in and it works automatically, no configuration needed at all. And it works in Mac OS X, but only if I have the actual printer drivers installed. And usually I know that I have an HP printer, so when I install Mac OS X, I discard all printer drivers except the one from HP, so I plug it in and it works. Mm. But the support of the number of printers isn't the only thing why that makes me believe that printer support in Linux is vastly superior to both other platforms. It's the fact that when it comes to cups, and in Ubuntu at least, it's literally plug and play. You plug it in and it works. There is no configuration necessary at all whatsoever. No driver installations, whatever. So maybe printers in Windows have a larger driver pool, but you have to install those drivers yourself, and that's a hassle. Usually they come with additional crapware and all the other nonsense.
Oh yes, there is no printer that comes without it.
Yeah, exactly. And when you plug in your printer in Ubuntu, I can guarantee you that it will work, because CUPS is really broad and it has a number of generic drivers as well. And in any case, you'll always be able to print in black and white, which is at least something, right? If you have a Windows machine and you buy a new printer, if you don't install drivers, it won't print at all. There's no there's no baseline or anything, baseline functionality ready for you. You're really dependent on that driver, and the driver again comes with crapware and additional stuff, and the ink levels are suggested to be way lower than they actually are, so that you be forced to buy more cartridges. Windows may support more printers because obviously that's what the manufacturers support, but I am 100% certain that getting a printer to work on Linux is easier these days than it is to get one to work on Windows or Mac. I'm 100% convinced of that one. So
I'll include another comment from another user regards to hardware. They say, Dark Nexus, hey, just for future reference, if you want to cite an example of an area of hardware where Linux is severely lacking, scanner support is the perfect candidate. It's one of those few areas where finding a new device that works with Linux is close to impossible. You often have to specifically go on a search for one that will work with Linux. More often than not, it has usually been discontinued a few years before you've bought it. Mm-hmm. Printer support and scanner support are polar opposites in Linux. 99.99% of printers will work right away, whereas if 5% of scanners work, that would be a miracle.
I actually have a scanner. I don't use it that often. It's in storage right now. But the problem is that it usually all the scanners that I've ever tried under Linux usually work because of Sane. The problem is that Sane doesn't have decent front ends. I haven't tried as of late, but I do recall that up until maybe a year ago, I'm not entirely sure, they had a Sane front end in Ubuntu that was so ridiculously overcomplicated and ugly that it made my head spin. It was impossible to use. I have no idea if they've improved that by now, but that front end was horrible. I mean, it was so horrible that I actually wanted to remove the actual package from the package manager. It was really, really, really horrible. So maybe it's not necessarily that printers don't work, because I believe that Sane supports a lot of printers, but that generally the front end isn't very good. The front end to Sane aren't very good and easy to use, because they usually just dump every possible option in the prime window, and scanners have a lot of options. Especially the bit more advanced scanners, and they don't hide functionality that your scanner doesn't have. So it might be the case that it's that the front end simply aren't good, but the back end is, because as far as I know, scanner support should be pretty good because of Sane. Actually, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not an expert when it comes to scanners, but I think stating that only 5% will work, I think that's way too low. I think it's more like 80 or 90%. But I'm no expert on that one.
Just finishing off, we go. Linux also has horrible power management features. On my T400, I get 5 plus hours in Windows, and I'm lucky if I get 3 hours on Ubuntu.
That's probably because the T400 is an IBM, it's a Lenovo machine, right? That's probably because Lenovo did a lot of work in giving you drivers that are tailor made for your T400 to work in Windows. Lenovo has not done that for Ubuntu, so Ubuntu doesn't have drivers specifically for the T4. I'm not entirely sure, but the drivers are not as optimized as the drivers for Windows are, because IBM Lenovo has put a lot of effort into their Windows drivers for your T400, but they haven't put a lot of effort into Linux drivers, if any at all. So it is a problem, obviously. I can definitely see that, but there is a story behind that, and it's not necessarily a problem with Linux, I think, but more of a problem with the fact that OEMs have not yet been supporting Linux as well as they are supporting Windows when it comes to drivers. So.
I've been trying to ditch Windows since 2005, and though I've seen many improvements, it is still not easier to use than Windows, and until that happens, Linux will not get the mainstream computer user. Hope my rant was not too long, but just disagree with a lot of things you said. Again, thank you for this great site and podcast, respectively, post-addiction. Thank you very much for the... I'd say an email almost. Since that was that long. Thank you very much for the comment. Okay, let's keep moving. This was another good comment, actually. We should cover this by Skywise, just down below that, about Apple clones. Good morning and thanks for the great show. The whole "who gives support if it breaks" thread on your podcast hits home with me as a user of a fake Mac product in the middle of the process of trying to get support. I own an EFIX boot module pre-boot to make the hardware look like a Mac, and I've been without my desktop since April because of firmware updates and faulty hardware. Presently, EFIX's firmware updater only works under OS X. A number of people have updated their OS X to 10.5.7 without realizing they should have updated the firmware of their boot module first. This caused their machine to no longer boot and get into a catch-22 situation regarding firmware updates. EFIX's original solution was to have a Windows updater, but then you'd need to buy a copy of XP/Vista to just update your firmware in case of something else goes wrong. With a refresh of the update server, the Windows solution is dead, and only OS X will do it, so if you can't get OS X booted, you have to send the module back to them for the update. To tide things over while I wait for my twice-dead module to come back, I went out and brought a MacBook Pro 13-inch, since there isn't too many clone Mac laptops out there. So I guess in the end, the clone market actually helped Apple sales. Anyway, to let you know what support can be important.
This is a... kind of a weird comment, because what we're talking about here is the EFIX module. If you read carefully and if you've been following the news, EFIX, the company that makes that module, isn't really into the Mac clone markets. They make a module that allows you to use EFI on normal BIOS machines. For instance, they do not allow clone makers to use the EFIX module so that you can install Mac OS X. It is possible, but as far as I know, it's not the main goal of the module, and they're really careful.
Yes, but then why would firmware updates only be available for OS X if you are clearly not going to be installing this in a Mac Pro?
I mean,
that's an odd behavior. That's what I thought was odd straight away.
Yeah, definitely. But like I said, I haven't been following EFIX that much. But what I understood from them is that they're not really into the whole cloning. It's not their prime business, so to speak. But yeah, you are right. The firmware updater only works under OS X. Again, we also have to reiterate that we can't actually test this because we don't have an EFIX module. So for all we know, there might be something wrong on your end, Skywise, instead of on EFIX's end. So it's really difficult to really say anything about this.
What I wanted to say about not necessarily this problem, but as we were discussing last week about getting support on a Hackintosh, is as elegant and as beautiful and as reliable a hack as Boot132 is, it is still a hack. There is zero guarantee from Apple that any point update or any major update is going to work, no matter how likely it is that Apple simply aren't testing. And so whilst it might be unlikely that Snow Leopard, you know, won't work on Boot132, there isn't a guarantee. It's still a hack. Is that what you should be basing a business on?
I don't see why not. I mean, for me, it's really simple. It's not about whether we think they should base a business on that. In the end, as long as you stay within the law, then the only possible measurement of wanting to start a business or not is how many machines you're able to sell. And seeing how many clone makers that are out there now, and the fact that PsyStar can actually get out of Chapter 11, and the fact that PeerC can actually expand, and the fact that Crow Computers can open a retail store, it means that there's a market for it. And if there's a market for a totally legal product, at least for now it's still legal because it hasn't been condemned by any court as of yet, which means it's a legal business to do. then the only measurement for that is if people want it or not. And seeing how the clone markets are growing, I think there's a market for it. And if there's a market for it, then more power to them. I mean, it's real simple. What we think about it doesn't matter, because we're obviously not their customers, right?
Yeah.
So it's just, I mean, I'm not a customer from Dell either, so I don't really care what they're doing.
Well,
right?
Let's look at the last point he made, which said is that whilst he was waiting for this solution to resolve itself, he actually went and bought a MacBook Pro 13-inch, since there aren't any clone laptops out there anyway at the moment. So if anything, the buying the clone in the first place just sent business Apple's way.
Yeah, that's good. I mean,
which is,
I don't see a problem with that. It's awesome. I mean, I don't really see what's good or bad about that. It's just good. It's good for Apple, obviously. That's true.
Okay, and yeah, I think that'll do for comments. We didn't get any emails, did we? No.
I think that the first story that we run into is the Mono one, right?
Yes. C Sharp CLI under Community Promise, Mono split in half.
Do you want to start?
I don't know if I can. I didn't actually read this. Basically, let's have a look. Microsoft have made a legally binding promise not to sue anyone who uses or distributes implementations of the ECMA ECMA parts of the ECMA standards parts of .NET.
Yeah, so that's the C-sharp language and the CLI. Those are the only two parts that are covered by the ECMA standards. And CLI is not command line interface, but it's common language infrastructure. So it's,
yes. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't include the WinDot forms and
no.
things like that.
And that's probably because those are Windows-specific technologies anyway. So I'm not entirely sure about that one.
Yes.
But basically, of course, as most of you will know, there's been a lot of talk recently about the inclusion of Mono in Linux distribution and whether that was dangerous or not because of the patents that Microsoft might or might not have over the ECMA standards and the other parts of .NET that are not covered by the ECMA standards. And then so a few people tried to contact Microsoft about getting a reasonable and whatever, some sort of reasonable patent license regarding the ECMA standards, which is a requirement by the ECMA standards body or whatever you call something like that. And Microsoft didn't respond, but as it turns out, the Mono project, with obviously Miguel de Casa specifically, were already talking with Microsoft about getting the ECMA standards parts under the Community Promise. And basically, Community Promise means that you do not have to sign a license agreement and you do not have to communicate with Microsoft how you will implement your specifications. You'll be completely free of any patent threats. You're completely free of any patent threats. And the promise applies to developers, distributors, and users of the implementations without regard to the development model. So you can be open source or closed source or whatever. And this is a legally binding promise, and it's perpetual. It means they can't revoke it in the future. It's made now, and it can never be revoked. So that's pretty good for Mono, I'd say, for the parts of Mono that are covered. And as a consequence of this, Miguel de Casa has explained that Mono will literally be split in half, meaning there will be two parts to the whole entire Mono project. Part one is everything that's covered by the ECMA standards and therefore covered by the Community Promise. So basically safe code that is completely free of any patent problems and threats. And then the other part of Mono will be the still legally ambiguous part, which are definitely covered by Microsoft patents, but do not fall under any promise and that are not an ECMA standard. And that's basically now part two of Mono that you can avoid installing in Linux. So it's I think whatever way you look at it, it's a good thing. But of course, it would have been better if everything from .NET would fall under the Community Promise. But yeah, you can.
Would it? I mean, we can say that. I mean, that only just solves a bunch of political problems. Is .NET any good? Does it belong in the Linux community in the first place? I mean,
That's a problem because I'm no programmer. I have absolutely no idea.
I'm a programmer, but just not this kind of level. And all the things is what the aspect that I cannot understand about it is why. Why use a language when the runtime is completely in question, or now it's completely half in question, so you can only use half a language?
No, you can use the entire language. But
all right, but half a runtime. You can only use half a runtime. You can't use the win.forms, etc.
Yeah.
If you want to have cross compatibility and the legal issue as well, patents. Oh, like if you're a company shipping something.
Yeah.
Why? C++ programmers must just be laughing at this. Because I don't understand why they're having to chase after this problematic dragon to pin it down so that they can then make use of it.
Well, probably because they think it's superior. I mean, if they think it's a superior solution, then more power.
I mean, the C# language is good. It is a good language. It may not be everybody's cup of tea, but I know that it is a good language. And to have the C# language clear is a good thing, because you can compile things with C# and not have to use Mono. They could spin that off and implement the C# language in GCC or something like that, and bypass the actual CLI. I think would be a good way of doing it, so that you can use the modern language but completely avoid all of the whole WinForms and just .NET entirely. It's just I cannot understand the reasoning behind why you'd want to support such a thing that you've got a half implemented system that you're always chasing after Microsoft. Microsoft can change what you're implementing at any point and break compatibility. Media is a problem because they've got to have Moonlight and you've got to have authentication from Microsoft to use that, and that is under its own set of licenses.
Yeah.
As well for the WMV binary blobs and it's a bag of hurt.
Yeah, well, for me basically the whole idea is that one, I don't really care. I've often said that about Mono.
True.
That I just don't care. I mean, I just want stuff that works, and preferably I want something that is free of any problems and threats and whatever. But in the end, if people want it, then other people should make it. I mean, it's not really, again, just with the whole clone discussion that we just had, it's not up to me to decide whether or not something is needed. If people want it, and apparently people want this, then, you know, more power to them. It's not really my place to question.
Well, think of it this way, because that's the divide between a product and programming. A product may want computers, that's fine, but here the users, the end user, such as person who buys a computer, is not the person who's making the decision that they want to use Mono. They might use the Tomboy application, but that's only because that's what's shipped in Ubuntu, for example. That doesn't mean that end users who are using Mono are the ones who actually demanded it. No, it's actual programmers and their own agendas that are demanding Mono.
Well, that's obviously true, but yeah, that's a good point, actually.
So, you know, is this agenda that's being done with the whole controversy over .NET, etc., is this being done in the interest of the end user, adding 50 meg to a live CD for the sake of a note-taking application when there's one written in C or C++ anyway?
Yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, when it comes to the open-source world, in the end, developers are, you know, coding for free, and they're coding for themselves, or for the company they work for, which is... pretty normal these days at least in the Linux world. But in the end, even if they're just coding it for themselves, then it's still for me a perfectly valid reason to pursue the matter. I mean, again, it's not my duty to tell them that they shouldn't do this.
Mm.
Whether I like it or not, I mean, if they want to do this and there's no problem for them, then, you know, and do it. I mean, I just don't really care. I mean, I'm really happy that, you know, that's under the community promise, and it solves a lot of the legal fog. Yeah, that's a good word. A lot of legal fog, which it clears a lot of the legal fog too.
Yes.
Put it nicely, and that's really good. But for the rest, I just don't really care. I don't even use Tomboy.
Yeah, it's. I should really. I'm probably complaining too much myself or getting too involved, because I don't program in C#. I certainly would never touch ASP.NET with a barge pole or IDEO.NET either. I think I'm done.
I don't even know what they are.
Microsoft technologies. well, ASP.NET is just the .NET-ized version of AS, the old ASP language. It's just lets you program say, like PHP, isn't it, really? Just ASP, etc. It's very good technology, but the problem is that because it's Microsoft-sized, it's generally you're completely tied to Windows. It does everything in a Microsoft way. It relies on Windows servers and just ends up tying you to Microsoft tools one way or another, no matter how much you try and deny it. Whereas with PHP, I think I've got a lot more freedom of choice of what to deploy on and what to run on and what tools I want to develop with. That's one of the things I don't like about .NET is that the free implementations will always and forever be behind, meaning that anyone who wants to get any real work done is going to be tied to a Microsoft platform.
Yeah, that's true.
So that doesn't really, you know, them chasing and following and implementing .NET only helps Microsoft sell more copies of Visual Studio.
And again, I don't care if it helps Microsoft. Then yeah, I mean, again, I just don't really see the problem. I mean, there are people apparently who want to work on this and who also want to use it, and you know, more power to them. I mean, it's not a crime. I mean, it's just I might not understand it as but then again, like I said, I'm not a programmer, so I don't understand it anyway. But again, I just don't really see the problem. I believe in one of the comments, one of the earliest Mono Controversy articles that I posted, I wrote in one of the comments that I kind of see Mono kind of like Austria. I mean, I know it's there, I know it's like next to Switzerland, but I just don't have any strong feelings one way or the other. No offense to all the Austrian people, but I just don't really have any strong feelings one way or the other. So and Mono is basically the same thing. I just don't really... I mean, I don't know enough about it to be in favor or against Mono, basically. So,
yeah, the blind leading the blind here. So, yeah. We'll take heed and we will move on.
Okay.
We are at 40 minutes, right? So we're doing good for time, actually. Let's, because I think we're going to spend some time on this next one. It is Google unveils a cloud-based operating system.
Yeah. The problem that I have so far with the Chrome operating system is that the Chrome operating system currently is nothing more than an announcement. That's all it is.
Yes.
There's absolutely nothing else. And... So we have an announcement that there's going to be something called the Chrome OS, which is apparently going to have something to do with... basically what we know is that it will use a Linux kernel, that it will be focusing on Google's web apps, but we don't even know how. Will those web apps be installed on the machine itself? We have no idea. It's called the Chrome OS, so it probably will have something to do with the Chrome web browser. And it will be available, first we thought in 2010, and then this weekend Eric Schmidt said that it might even be sooner. That's all we know. But you wouldn't say that we only know that if you look at the amount of articles that people have written on the damn World Wide Web. I mean, it's like we've got...
It's a speculation frenzy.
Yeah, and I just try to stay away from it as much as possible, because still we don't have anything more than an announcement and three questions posted on an FAQ article on the Google blogs. That's all we have. And
I thought that title was pretty badly worded, unveiled, because they haven't unveiled a thing. They've just said that they're going to make an operating system. One thing to note, of course, is always that they've denied vehemently before that there is no Google OS, because that this rumor has been going for a long time. In fact, that said, we had an article in 2005 written by contributor Chris Schaefer, who pretty much got guessed at .com.
Yeah. I just, I find it really hard to discuss something that doesn't exist. I mean, sometimes at least you have like a screenshot or something, or you have a list of features, or you have other people who have used it or whatever, but we don't know anything about this.
We don't need to necessarily know anything about the operating system to discuss. I think one of the factors that you can draw out of this, whether it's Google's operating system or not, and that is a cloud-based computing.
Yeah, I'm not...
Whether it can work, and whether at the moment, whether that needs it to be at the operating system level before it can solve that that problem of cloud computing, of it being practical, because technically you can do it already. There's Google Apps and you've got Google Mail, etc. But what I assume this operating system is going to be is basically it's a Linux kernel with an ultra thin user space, which is just Google Chrome, basically the browser. That's it. And they dump pretty much everything else, and then do as much applications as possible through HTML5.
Well, I think that's definitely a possibility, but I think that's taking it a step too far, conceptually speaking, when it comes to the whole cloud thing. I think that it's going to have more in common with Palm's web operating system, in that it uses web languages as an SDK, basically. Yeah. But those web languages will allow you to access the entire device. So a lot of people compare the WebOS to the early days of the iPhone operating system, but that's a completely nonsensical comparison. Yeah, because basically, when it comes to the WebOS, you use web languages, yes, but you have access to everything in the device, so you have access to the hardware.
Yeah, you have a JavaScript API to be able to interface with the computer itself, because I think someone made a smart comment about the Google operating system, maybe this was on Twitter, and they said, oh, good luck playing a DVD or using the webcam on it. And that's very true to an extent. I mean, how are they going to be able to play a DVD using a web browser?
Yeah, so basically, I don't think that's going to happen. So I think it's more WebOS-like in that it might be geared towards the web and it will use web languages for the SDK.
But a web browser will definitely be a primary feature
of
it. Yeah,
but that's basically the same thing of the WebOS. You don't see it, but basically you're running a browser which is showing different web pages. Technically, the web pages are all locally, and they can do a lot more than a normal web page can. But technically, you're just using at several, you're just looking at several WebKit instances on your Palm Pre.
Well, it's a lot like the dashboard on Mac OS X, and that's the exact same thing. It's just a bunch of widgets that are all written in HTML and JS, and they just run as web pages with transparent backgrounds on a separate layer. So they can do pretty much the same sort of thing with Google Chrome OS perhaps, and as well as the web browser itself being a primary sort of feature, and abstract away a lot of the need for creating a lot of the tools that you need in an operating system, word processor, spreadsheet, and solve a lot of the software problem just by using the web, because that's what most people use the computers now for. They're just glorified internet boxes despite all the power that you get.
Yeah, like my super awesome quad core that never goes over 20% usage. But yeah, it was cheap. I mean, come on. But yeah, that's definitely. But what I am afraid of is how the Chrome OS will work when there's no internet connection.
This is how they're going to manage networking and stuff like this. That's a really interesting thing, because that's stuff. You've got the driver situation, and I suppose they're going to be piggybacking a lot of stuff on Linux, because there will be Linux using a Linux kernel, although they won't be using the Linux user space. And
that's an interesting point when it comes to drivers, because they're saying that they've written their own graphical environment. I'm not entirely sure if they've written the entire graphical environment, but Linux might have really great video driver support, but that's all X Windows. It's not. If you remove X Windows, you don't have the drivers. So
I think Google are doing something very, very interesting here. I would actually say they're doing the right thing here. Maybe not by making the operating system as comprehensive as a real operating system that we're used to, but they're doing the right thing by forgetting the Linux user space. Because the stacks in Linux are ancient, poorly designed for modern computing, inefficient, unreliable across the board, and so fragmented. I mean, the video stack, you've got 11 layers or so before you get down to the actual hardware, because you've got the X-windowing system, and you've got the compiz, and you've got all the layers in between that. The audio system is a joke. It looks like a graph of the history of AT&T with all the mergers and splits and everything. and that's what...
Yeah, but that's kind of sad, because I do believe that Genome and KDE4, you know, there's so many good ideas in there, and they've really put a lot of work in it, but they're all hampered by the fact that there's 10 million layers between them and the hardware.
Yeah.
It's really sad, because both the developers on the Genome project and the KDE project, they're really bright people, and they've done a lot of good work in making a very, very good desktop environments. But sadly, they're really held back by the fact that... Again, Linux just wasn't originally designed for modern desktop computing. I mean, people can jump up and down all they want, but it's layer upon layer upon layer and bandage above bandage above bandage. And it shows. I mean, it's really easy, people won't agree with that, but it's really easy actually to topple over the whole Linux stack and have it come crashing down like Icarus. So it's much harder to bring down, at least that's how I see it, it's much more difficult to bring down macOS 10 or Windows 7 than it is to bring down the Linux distribution. It's much easier. It's like a Jenga tower, right? The Jenga tower for macOS 10 and Windows is maybe 3 layers high, and in comparison, the Ubuntu Jenga tower is like 20 layers high. So it's really much easier to bring it down than it is.
Yeah, the X windowing system, the design for it was for the 1960s, 1970s terminals and timeshare based machines and so forth, and might work great for that. Running it all locally has had all huge. They've had to do so many hacks to do buffering, and they've had to do so many hacks to do with input capture, and they've had to do so many hacks to be able to get it to work with Compass as well. Not everything works correctly because of this, that, and everything. And kernel mode setting was a real hack to get that in as well.
Yeah.
So they could get high resolutions at the lower boot process because X wasn't loaded. And gosh. The whole thing needs to be scrapped, I think, to do any radical rethink. I'm not saying get rid of GNOME and KDE, but it would be... I think the GNOME and KDE devs would really love it if the pressure was just off of them to have to support so many different systems, and they could just get one unified system, reliable system to the hardware, a lot like what macOS has got with core audio and core video and all the core technologies that provide a low-level, low-latency, reliable system to the hardware, and you don't have to deal with pulse audio and phone on and everything else, and some implement some features and others don't implement others, and then some sit on top of others and vice versa, and it just I could not begin to imagine how much of a headache it must be.
I definitely agree, and I hopefully to draw this discussion back to Google, that they scrap most of that and just start basically, kind of what Robert Szeleney is currently doing with SkyOS. Just use the kernel and get your own user end on top. And well, Google has a lot more money, obviously. And
I think what Google will probably do then is they'll slice deals with OEMs, which we've already heard is the case, and they'll probably just write their own drivers to begin with. And be able to publish the APIs so that because it's using a Linux kernel, it should be mostly easy or instantaneous to port drivers to their operating system. Just a few changes here and then recompile, hopefully, or something like that. But I suspect why they're going to OEMs first is A, they want shelf space. They don't want people to have to download this operating system. They want people to be able to get this operating system on a machine because they understand the package problem as well. And that they want to also then provide a good hardware experience by, again, working with the OEMs and then writing their own drivers or doing whatever's necessary to get the right drivers for the system so that it is reliable. Because a flaky operating system isn't going to change anything. It's going to change the world.
And what's interesting is that the Chrome OS will be also written for the ARM, written at least compiled for the ARM platform. And I think that's really... very, very welcomed by OEMs who may be a bit hesitant right now to produce ARM netbooks because A, it doesn't have Windows, and B, Canonical simply isn't a very big name behind Ubuntu. It's a small company that's continuously making a loss, and I can understand that big OEMs aren't really comfortable with working with Canonical. And users too, obviously. And then despite the fact that I think Ubuntu is a great operating system, don't get me wrong. It's just that, you know, it doesn't have any big names behind it, right? And so I think the OEMs are really happy when it comes to the ARM space, that the fact that Google is behind the Chrome OS and it will be available for ARM. So that means that the OEMs can provide the same user experience across the board, whether they're making ARM devices or x86 devices. So it's really good. I think that the OEMs
are
really happy.
Well, one thing I get quite often is I've got a number of customers and customers quite often get confused between web browsers and Google, and they seem to think that either Google is a web browser or something like that. Like they ask, oh, Firefox, can that do Google, or is that Google, or will Google still work? And they just kind of hint at believe that Google is a web browser or something, or is the internet, or things like that. So the Google name is certainly much more powerful, and I think if people see that when they go to a store and it's got, you know, it's got Google, then then they're going to be much more confident with these devices than perhaps, unfortunately, Ubuntu, as good as Ubuntu is.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's probably, I mean, Google, like I said, Google is a much bigger name than Ubuntu or Canonical is. I mean, it's just a simple fact, a big name is half the work, I think, when it comes to getting your stuff out there. But still, that doesn't mean it will be easy for Google, because, you know, there are so many people have tried to make a true dent into Windows market share. And, I mean, Apple has been at it for God knows how long, trying to get there. And they really needed a stupid music player to get there. So it's and a phone, actually. So,
well, then arguably Google has got there by having search first and having the brand name first.
That's true. So, I mean, they can really leverage their presence online with Gmail and the search engine, obviously. And then hopefully that will make them a big player in the operating system space, because, you know, the more players, the merrier. I mean, the more players there are, the more calls there will be for interoperability, and the more interoperability, the easier it will be for even more players to enter the space. So, you know, big thumbs up from this guy. I mean, I think it's a good idea. It's a good thing across the board, basically. Mm-hmm. I probably won't use it if it's too much too into the whole cloud-based thing, because I don't trust cloud-based stuff. But
there's still a number of issues with the whole cloud-based thing. Yeah. I think there's a lot of design principles that just simply haven't been solved. However, Google themselves have been very much forthright, and I would actually say Apple as well. They're doing the same sort of job. Is that what they're doing? Is they're embracing the standards, and then they're finding new ways to fix the faults of the standards, and then they're putting them forward as new standards, and mostly getting adopted. So it's not. It's like embrace, extend, extinguish, but they're actually just embracing and extending. And that's it.
Yeah.
And doing that in a loop, because Apple, for example, the OpenCL sort of thing, in 6 months they put together OpenCL and then got it ratified as a standard. So that now we don't have to deal with NVIDIA doing CUDA and ATI doing another thing, and then another graphic card doing another thing, and we've just got unified GPU computing.
Yeah.
And the same is with Google as well. Their work with HTML5 and Google Wave is that they are really pushing forward the standards, and where there's holes in the standards, like drag and drop in a browser, so you can drag files from the browser and drop them, drag files from the file system and drop them in the browser, which we should have been able to do for ages.
Uploading
is such a difficulty on web browsers, and they're now that's it part of Google Gears, and so they're now trying to push that forward as part of the HTML5 specification as well. And I hope they're successful with that, because it will then mean a lot of other browser vendors will happily adopt it, because it's part of another specification that they're tracking. I think they might be able to solve a lot of these cloud integration problems.
Well, this is fun, because you just said, like, drag and drop into the browser, and I obviously have a browser window open. And I have part of my thesis as a Word file on my desktop, and I tried to drag it into Chrome 3, and it downloaded the file. So it popped up in the download bar, and now it's in the download window, like thesis intro.doc, show in folder, file, C users, tomorrow, etc. It's pretty fun. Anyway, just a stupid little thing. So yeah, I really hope that they're going to fix some of those things, and that they're going to make a few things standard, because indeed, the drag and drop thing is really a good example, because every time you have to upload something to the web, you have to open like the file open dialog and browse through the file.
And you can
file.
Only do one file at a time. Yeah, it's just a complete pain, or it's got to use Flash, and that's just horrible.
Yeah. So let's hope that, again, I really hope that they're going to get somewhere with the Chrome operating system, but I am very skeptical. One, because there isn't anything to look at right now, and two, because I'm still not really sold on the whole cloud and continuously online thing. So
we've always been able to do this ever since, we've been able to do this since probably 1996, 1997. I'd suspect perhaps even earlier. The only thing that's different is that's changed on all this time is server technology has moved on a bit, and design trends have moved on a bit.
Yeah,
cloud computing really isn't. Cloud computing started when whoever invented the first scripting language that ran on a server.
Yeah, and obviously the big difference is that now, at least in the Western world, almost everybody has internet connection, and 12 years ago nobody had, so that's kind of an important difference.
Well, it's still only a quarter of the world's population. It's still.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Western world.
Of
course, it's a completely different issue, sadly enough.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, I've run out of steam.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add here. Like I said, it's just an announcement. We've been able to talk about an announcement for 20 minutes, so, I mean, more power to us, I'd say.
Hopefully we'll have a busier week next week with news.
Don't
and
count
so
on
forth.
It. Don't count on it.
Or at least things that I know how to talk about.
Yeah, same here. That will be really welcome.
Okay, thank you very much. Meta, let's cover the finals. Email. If you'd like to contribute to the show at all or say anything, please email us at osnews-crew@osnews.com or leave your comments in the comment thread on the website, osnews.com, when we publish the podcast, obviously. Mm-hmm. Twitter, you may follow us on Twitter, although what we say on Twitter has little relevance to do with OS News. It's just our normal shoutings and rantings and what we ate for breakfast.
And curse words. In my case, please. Sorry.
You can catch... I'm at twitter.com/croc. That's KROC.
And I'm at /TomHawarda. And as always, just check the website, OS News, for how it's spelled.
Mm-hmm. Well, secondly, lastly, I would like also to say is that we would like to eventually get someone on the show, it still amazes me that we haven't managed to achieve this so far. Our own staffers haven't been around because that's just usually Sunday it's a day people want off ultimately, and
family day,
and not to be inside doing this. And but we would love to get a reader on the show, and all you got to do is just email us and ask. If you're available on Sunday around about probably 12:01 PM GMT or 5 PM GMT, then we can fit you in. And if you've got all you need to do is be able to record on your own computer using Audacity, whatever, and have iChat or Skype to be able to make a phone call, and that's it. We'd love to have someone on the show. You don't have to be an expert about your topics, because neither are we.
And... I was about to say, neither are we.
Exactly. It is just a chat. That is all this show is about. It's just a look of what's on the page and a chat about our to express our own opinions or to reveal our own opinions through how we discuss those items. So we would love it if someone could join us on the show.
Definitely.
Okay, and with that, I think we shall wrap everything up. I'm Croc Heyman. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Yeah, and I'm Tom Howard, and also thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you all next week, hopefully.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.